these animals are living the longest, and they have the highest levels of oxidative stress. You know, a few decades ago, that sort of flipped things on its head a little bit in the terms of this longevity, you know, healthy aging realm, because it really emphasized the fact that it is your resiliency. It is your capacity to cope with the stress that matters.
This is the Entrepology Podcast, the podcast where we optimize the bodies, brains, and lifestyles of entrepreneurs, go-getters, and world-changing innovators.
Welcome to the Entrepology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Megan Walker. As a naturopathic doctor and anthropologist, I optimize the health and performance of badass women working to change the world as entrepreneurs and go-getters. You know, people exactly like you. Your business, body, balance, and inner badass. These are the themes we are exploring. So if you've been hanging out with us over the last few weeks, you realize there's a theme we've been exploring, and that's this idea of biohacking. Over the last few weeks, we looked at red light therapy. We talked about HRV and this cool device called a Leaf. And today is kind of the grand finale of this triple threat of biohacking that we've been having over the last few weeks. And today I had the pleasure of welcoming my colleague and friend, Dr. Mark Bubbs. Dr. Bubbs is a naturopathic doctor, speaker, performance nutrition lead for Canada Basketball, and he is the author of his new second book, Peak, the new science of performance that is revolutionizing sports, an integrated and personalized approach to athlete health, nutrition recovery, and mindset. And here's the thing, Dr. Bubbs knows that my audience is not necessarily elite super athletes, but we are elite and we are super. And what we are always looking for is a little bit of an edge as it pertains to performance. And that's what we went about today. We didn't necessarily go deep on any one topic. We hit a bunch of highlights. We talked about metabolic rate. We talked about how to have coffee, how to dose it, how to leverage it in exercise, to keto or not to keto. How do we really start to hack our sleep to optimize recovery? And what sort of recovery cues should we be looking at from our body when we're trying to understand whether it's time to go hard or pull back? This interview ran a little bit longer than most because I just couldn't stop asking questions. From mindset to tactics to food to movement, we covered it all as we wrapped up our biohacking series. If you've heard Mark speak before, you know that you are in for a treat. He is a wealth of knowledge, and it is my absolute pleasure to welcome back to the podcast my friend, Dr. Mark Bubbs. Dr. Mark Bubbs, welcome back to the Entrepology Podcast.
Amazing. Dr. Meg, thanks so much for having me on.
I'm really stoked to get back into this. I haven't had you on the Entrepology Podcast for about 100 episodes or an entire book ago, as the case may be for you. Can you give everybody a bit of an update on who you are and what you've been up to since you were here last?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm a naturopathic doctor from Toronto, and I work in performance as well with Canada Basketball as the performance nutrition lead. And so for me, you know, in clinical practice, I work with a lot of athletes and active people who are really trying to push the limits a little bit in terms of achieving some goals, and also work with, you know, the rest of us who are trying to just get through the day, you know, perform well at home, perform well at work, and, you know, have enough energy left over to have time for friends and family on the weekends, right?
Well, and that's just it. I think the reality is, you and I were both chatting about this beforehand. We both have three kids. And whether or not we would identify as athletes, I will not. We need to actually be in peak performance just about all the time, or we're going to get run over and attacked and eaten by small people. And so just executing as entrepreneurs in our world requires that we are in a state of high performance. So I'm actually really looking forward to kind of delving in to some of the things and some of the misconceptions that actually exist around peak performance. And so if we started there, if we went, okay, of all the things that we could do with respect to performance, if there was just one thing that you could give somebody to start to do, if they were like, I just need to execute at a higher level in my life, what would you get them to do?
Yeah, this was really fascinating part of researching in the book and being able to connect with different performance teams and various sports and various, you know, elite athletes. And one of the things that really jumps out is this idea that elite performance is incompatible with frequent illness, and even not just actually having an infection, but the symptoms that you would get if you were tired or run down or fatigued. And that's not always something that we, you know, sort of put our finger on, because this notion of consistency, of just being able to show up day in, day out, and really perform at 90% of what you can do, right? Not have days where you're 110%, but then losing weeks because you're 70%, but really trying to be consistent throughout the week, throughout the month, throughout the year. And the amazing part is this goes for your nutrition, it goes for your exercise, it goes for lifestyle factors, and it dovetails into everything that would, you know, for an entrepreneur in terms of being successful and being able to maintain that pace and not, you know, not burn out, not get run down, and not struggle to be able to cope, right? Because resiliency is such a big piece of this whole story.
And what are you finding? Are you finding that people are like high performers, and then they hit a wall and they just keep getting sick and they're in a rut? Or do you find that there's just people who are inherently like not well? They're just like, oh, I'm always sick, I'm always susceptible. Or is it a bit of both?
It's a little bit of both. And I think when we see people who are, you know, high performers in their job, and then they want to improve their health, they maybe want to lose some weight, they want to upgrade their exercise or nutrition, they tend to have that mindset of really going for it hard in that first 2 weeks or 4 weeks or even 6 weeks, and trying to see, you know, a lot of gains in a very short amount of time. And that can be fine, but it's really, you know, the amount of effort and intensity there is, it's difficult to maintain in the long run, because the rest of their life is going to get busy. And so they're committing a lot of resource in this very finite window. And again, when you look at nutrition, when you look at training, whoever actually just shows up and does the training over the course of a year, you know, great work by Dr. Dan Clether, St. Mary's University in the UK, that's the person who gets the fittest, not the one who came out of the gates and had a great 4 weeks or was really motivated. And so I think that's a nice aspect of when people are working with a trainer, a coach, you know, a doctor, a naturopath who's trying to lay out a path for 6 months down the road or a year down the road, right? Rather than this, and again, transformations in 4 weeks can be a little bit fun sometimes, but it's not nearly as sustainable as the interwebs and Instagram would have you believe, right?
Yeah. And have you found that, I see this in practice, so I'm curious your perception on it, but I find often the people who are consistently getting sick, they're also the people who have less respect or less understanding around the idea of recovery. So they keep getting sick, and yet the moment they feel slightly better, they're back at that spin class, or they're like pushing themselves at a million miles an hour. Can you just, there's two pieces there. Can we just talk about recovery in general and the importance, and I would argue the need to really revere recovery in as a tactic for performance, but also this idea of like, what the heck do we do about working out and pushing hard physically when we are consistently feeling unwell or under the weather?
For sure. I mean, it definitely includes the folks that are getting sick frequently, but a huge swath of people here are not even getting sick. They're the ones who are going to the gym, and all of a sudden their performance doesn't really get much better. You know, they're not lifting more weight. They're not, you know, their aerobic fitness isn't improving. Maybe their weight loss is plateaued, and they're unsure of where to go next. And just as you mentioned, this idea of recovery, when we look at the best athletes in the world, even the best sports scientists will tell you it's really less about overtraining than it is more, as you mentioned, under recovery. And you always think, well, listen, these are professional athletes. They're training really intensely. That's got to be more intense than me with my job and what I'm doing. But when you actually think about it, you have a long day at the office. You're working 8, 10, 12 hours, whatever it might be. If you've got commitments, family, kids at home, all of a sudden you're not sleeping as much as you should be. You're the one who's actually doing the cooking. You know, elite athletes have a chance to have a, you know, 90-minute nap in the afternoon. Someone might be cooking their food for them. So all of a sudden, what we call training load for an athlete, which is the amount of, you know, sets and reps and the total stress in the system, is mainly coming from the physical side and a little bit mental. But for the rest of us, it's the life load. It's the work. It's the lack of sleep. It's all those other things that are contributing. And that's this idea of under recovery then. You just, you know, you're not able to build that resiliency that you need to really improve your, you know, your fitness. And when I say fitness, it's even that sort of mental side of things as well, because I'm sure everyone's experienced at some point when you do hit a nice run in the gym or you're being active, you know, all of a sudden, you know, your mindset, your mental game is really strong, and it really dovetails with your physical fitness. And that's one of the big things when you're stuck. That's typically what's going on, is we're not respecting that recovery. And then the training plan that someone might be following is just not thoroughly enough laid out to really have kind of a longer term picture, right? As if you're investing your money. You know, people always think longer term, but when we think about fitness and weight loss, for some reason we get stuck in what can you do for me in 4 weeks, right?
We're that immediate gratification culture. So if I can't lose all the weight in 4 weeks, I'm just not even sure it's worth the effort.
Yeah, when you look at like elite, and this isn't to say that people need to be, you know, bodybuilders or figure competitors, but these people get paid to get lean. And the best of the best take 26 weeks. They take half the year to get to where they're going to go. And so, and they're only aiming for about a pound and a half, or 2 pounds of fat loss in a week. When you tell that to people, it doesn't sound as sexy as, hey, I can, you know, let's take 20 pounds off in 4 weeks. And, you know, being able to lay out a plan and show people over the long term that if you do it in such a way, once you get to where you want to go, you can maintain with very little effort. It's a lot easier to maintain than it is to get there. And unfortunately, when you do it a little bit too quickly, and of course, we're talking on the body composition side here, but if you do it too quickly, you lose muscle mass. And when you lose muscle mass, your metabolic rate slows down, right? If you're dieting too much and you're dropping calories too low, your metabolism slows down again. If stress is high at work or you're not sleeping as well, again, you get this drop in metabolism. And that's one that most people don't realize, that 60 or 70% of the calories that you're burning in a day is simply your resting metabolic rate, right? It's the calories you're burning just to be alive, just when you're sitting at your desk or sleeping. And if you start to, if that fatigue builds up too much, that, you know, that total stress load, life load, then that's going to really be a huge stumbling block for, again, being able to find that ideal weight, but also as that dovetails to, you know, your mindset and feeling sharp and really actually feeling your best versus feeling like you're sort of just slugging it out every day and, you know, making it through as best you can.
So I actually really resonate with this idea of getting lean in 26 weeks over 4. And maybe that's a commentary of my own level of fatigue right now, but that just feels like a much more achievable goal. And so if that was in fact the case, what kinds of activities should someone be looking at? Because I think what happens when someone's like, okay, I'm going to get in shape, they go back to their tried and true. So if they're a runner, they go back to their running. Or if they're spinners, they spin. Or if they like to lift weights. And it hasn't it's not necessarily, you know, what does the research say is the complement of activities that gets people, I'm not going to say the leanest, the fastest, but like, let's say over that 26 weeks.
Yeah. And that's a great question. And it's one that is very individual. So typically, like you mentioned, if someone's struggling, especially if they're a type A personality, it's like, well, I've been doing 2 spin classes a week. I want to get fitter or leaner. Then 3 or 4 must be better, right? Or if they're in the gym, they just
add more. Stop talking about me, Mark.
They add more sessions rather than, you know, again, if you go back, you know, the book is all about the fundamentals. And this is what all these elite performance staffs are all about, is being a master of the fundamentals. They're not using a lot of these shiny new toys that we sort of read about and hear about. And one of those fundamentals is progressive overload. So you've got to make things get more difficult or heavier in the gym. And ironically, if we talk, you know, women's fitness, then the heavier the load gets, the adaptations are just neurological. So there's no hypertrophy, there's no size gain. And that's often a stumbling block, because a lot of, you know, female clients don't want to get, they don't want to add hypertrophy, right? They don't want to get bigger necessarily. But building up to those heavier loads is a big part of the story. And the amazing thing is that when you look at the research around how much you have to do in a week, you know, to even get a really, you know, impressive results, 10 total sets for the week for body part. And that can be all, it can be done in one session. So you could literally set a timer on your phone. And some of these workouts in terms of circuit style, or you see this in CrossFit, every minute on the minute, you start your timer on your phone, you might do 10, 15 squats. And then once it gets to 1 minute, you repeat that, you know, it probably takes you about 20 or 30 seconds. So you do get this 20 or 30 second rest. And by the end of 10 minutes, you've knocked out your 10 sets. So you're good for the week for that, you know, whether it's legs or upper body or whatever you might be doing.
So 7-minute abs is a thing.
So it can be a thing. It's just a way that it's then overloaded in the long term. But it's more this idea that a lot of people just decide to not engage in the exercise because it's like, well, I don't have an hour. I can't get to the gym,
right?
Change, stretch, all these types of things. And so once you get to that level of time being a real problem, this is where you can figure out some really cool strategies of simplifying things, of picking an upper, a lower, and an abdominal exercise, and just overloading those as the weeks go on, and it's easier for you to keep track and to remember how you're progressing. And it's amazing how you can start to get results with sort of, you know, quote unquote, little effort.
Is that the same for men and women?
It really is the same for men and women. And ironically, I mean, pound for pound, women are stronger than men in the lower body. And it's one of those ones where, you know, eventually you do need some loads. So whether it's some kettlebells at home or a barbell at the gym or whatever it might be. The thing people forget as well is this idea of when you train, it's a down payment. You have a training age, which means you do get this sort of compound interest as you go from year to year. And there's a tremendous sports scientist out west, Trent Stellingworth, Canadian Sport Institute in the Victoria. And he actually did a 9-year study on an Olympic middle distance runner. And it just so happens that that middle distance runner is his wife. So it was easier for him to collect data. But this idea of body composition periodization. So over this 9 years, whenever Hillary had a competition, she was lean, she was ripped. It was that picture that you see in the cover of a magazine, you know, healthy looking, all that. But the periods in between that you don't see in the magazine and nobody posts on Instagram. So when she was in her off season, she would, you know, regain 6, 7, 8% body fat. And so for overall health and athlete health, this is essential. And of course, as the 9 years went, every time there was this optimization period, right, this peaking for competition, every cycle she would be leaner than the previous cycle. Now this is, you know, over 9 years is a really macro way to look at it, but it's amazing to think that, wow, when you look at it that way, you can actually start to compound the benefits you're getting from 1 year to the next. Whereas, you know, unfortunately, a lot of people are sort of, they get stuck and they use a bit of a shotgun approach of, okay, I did this and it didn't work, so I'll try something else. But they don't zoom up a little bit to 30,000 feet and get back to the principles of just saying, well, maybe I've just been doing the same spin class at the same intensity. You know, your body's now adapted to it. So you're actually going to be using less and less calories every time you train. And, you know, you need to switch it up a little bit. In the short term, adding more sessions in a week might be good, but oftentimes if you like classes, then even adding more tension, you know, trying to make it so that you actually can't make it through the class. I know nobody wants to feel that way, but adding enough tension, and if there's a watt meter on your spin class bike, then that's one way you can check how much power you're generating, because that's actually going to be sort of the key. So there's little ways like that. And you know, actually in the book, we talk about, you know, there's all sorts of technology you can use, but just your subjective feeling of how you're doing is almost pound for pound as good as the tens of thousands of dollars worth of equipment that, you know, professional teams and us at Canada Basketball use. So just asking yourself on a scale of 1 to 10, you know, how hard was that sprint, is a pretty good way to estimate how hard you were working. So that's kind of a nice way, you know, when you go back to your group classes or even when you're training yourself in the gym, to be able to evaluate, okay, was that a tough day or was that, you know, moderate or easy?
Yeah, well, I have a little Whoop. I'm not sure if you've used these or what you think of them, but it's interesting because it measures the ratio between recovery and strain. But after it detects that you've had a workout, or in my case, when I've also put my kids to bed, it asks me to rate how hard I thought I worked. And I find that really interesting on both a psychological level and then to start to correlate that data in terms of how hard it perceived that I worked over that given workout. So I do think there's really a lot of power to this idea of also just subjectively recording your effort.
Yeah. And you see that a lot with the different apps, is that, you know, a daily wellness questionnaire has been validated to be, you know, equivalent to some of these tools that you might use in a high performance setting. And it, again, it's a great way to be able to say, you know, was that a 9.5 out of 10? Was I really going for it? Or was that an 8? And that doesn't mean you should always be at a 9 or 9.5, but a simple way over a month is to say, hey, I should be starting out at a 6.5, 7. By the end of the month, I should be close to a 10. And then you repeat that from month to month, and you should be, you know, improving as you go along that way. It's a great way to do it.
Yeah. And the naturopath in me also is thinking about this idea of also just be mindful of what else is going on in your life. Like back to this idea that you talked about before in terms of total load or allostatic load. I have a lot going on right now. I've backed off on my exercise. I've been consistent, but I haven't gone quite as hard because I can feel it. I can't recover as efficiently as I otherwise would.
Absolutely. And that's the beauty of some of these subjective values, because we know when your nervous system's getting run down, if we were to actually put you in a lab and assess your work output, you wouldn't be able to do as much work, or for the same amount of given work, your heart rate would be higher. So you'd see this sort of effect of the nervous system not being able to keep up. And that's what's really nice about these subjective you know, values is that, yeah, it's taking into account the fact that you had a really long week or you didn't sleep well, because the hard drive, the brain's going to be taking all that into account. So definitely a great, great tool.
I want to move on from exercise, but before we do, you've given us this amazing tip in terms of doing, 10 reps. It's 10 reps, right? 10 total sets or 10 total reps?
So you could do 10 sets. So every minute on the minute, and you can pick the amount of reps, and then, go from there.
And then how do we balance that out with cardio?
Cardio is an interesting one because, again, for people who are, let's say, struggling to recover enough, or that resiliency piece is lacking, despite the fact that the person oftentimes, again, if you're type A, you feel like you're mentally tough enough to keep going. But if you were to be assessed, you could tell the nervous system's actually, like a duck on water. The feet are really paddling away like crazy under the surface. The fact that slow, steady state aerobic work is actually, like a big hug for your nervous system. It's a great way to reboot and rebuild your nervous system. But it's tough to tell people sometimes to work out slower. If you think of this sort of barbell approach of the two ends of the barbell being polar opposites. So we have sort of higher intensity at one end, let's say it's the right side. And on the left side, we've got slow, steady state. And what we want to try to do is not spend loads of time in the middle. We want to be working quite hard, or we want to be doing lots of slow, steady state. Because again, the best aerobic, endurance athletes in the world spend 80% of their training in an aerobic heart rate zone. The trouble is they're so damn fast to the rest of us, it looks like they're sprinting. But adding those slower, steady states is a great way to get some aerobic fitness in, to build mitochondria, to oxygenate the brain, to improve focus. But it's not going to beat up your nervous system, because the reality is most people who are recreational exercisers are spending too much time in the middle, in that sort of glycolytic burn sort of area, which is fun for a little while, but it's going to be taxing on the nervous system for sure.
Yeah, this is really great advice, either end of the spectrum. All these type A people are like, I got this. I'm an all or nothing kind of person. So you totally have captured my attention. Now, what do we do about balancing out the nutrition on top of the movement piece? Let's assume we're on this 26-week plan. What's the overarching philosophy here?
The nutrition piece is obviously a huge part of the whole story. And it's a fascinating one because obviously – there's a strong emotional tie to what we eat, right? It's like,
what's the one diet for everybody, Mark?
Yeah, don't talk religion or politics at dinner. I think the third one at a dinner party is don't talk about your diet.
So true.
But no, when we look at, if we stay on this endurance discussion here, even in the guidelines from the American College of Sports Medicine, et cetera, they suggest that, 30 to 50% of the time when, elite athletes are training, they should purposely restrict the amount of calories that are going in. And to simplify this, we'll just say carbohydrates that are going in, because that's typically the one that gets manipulated. So you think, wait a minute. So the most elite, who are sub 10% body fat, they're spending 50% of their sessions where they're strategically consuming fewer carbohydrates or no carbohydrates before these sessions. Now, when they need to perform on race day or when it's an intense session, they'll definitely add more in. But for the rest of us, the recreational exercises, you think, geez, well, we could bump that up to even 2/3 of the training sessions, where you get up in the morning, you have a coffee, and you train. You don't, unfortunately, a lot of us have been convinced that we need to add fuel like we're Eliud Kipchoge setting a record at the Berlin Marathon or racing in the Tour de France. But we don't need nearly as much carbohydrate on board, because if we're trying to lose some weight, then we've got calories on us that we can use, right? And we just have to, if we fuel in a certain way, then the body gets better at using your own fuel reserves. And so these are called train low strategies. We talk about those in the endurance chapter in the book. And it's a great way, it's a great time consuming way, or I mean a time efficient way rather, in the morning to say, hey, I'm going to have a coffee, I'm going to go do my cardio or train. And then on the back end, I might have some breakfast. And the interesting thing is, when we look at some of the research around, even if you added a protein shake or a serving of protein, that wouldn't actually interfere with your ability to burn body fat as you did that morning workout. So if you really did want to have something, then you could actually lean on those things as well. That's a nice kind of first place to start in terms of, tweaking your diet.
And what do we do in the back end of that workout?
That's a great question as well. This is where, depending on how much you've been tinkering with this, you can explore different things. But I'll give you an example of one that's more of the sledgehammer approach, if you will. If people like to have that barbell approach, let's go for the sledgehammer. It's called a sleep low. So what that would entail is, on a in the evening, you go to the gym, you have your intense session. Maybe it's a weight session in the gym. Maybe it's that hardcore spin class. And on the back end of that, you're going to just have proteins and fats. So you're limiting your carbohydrates, which means you're limiting how much glycogen, how much of the carbohydrate stores in your muscle that you're topping back up. So you do that, then you sleep through the night. Of course, overnight, as you're sleeping, you're using your liver glycogen, so the carb stores in your liver, to fuel, you know, ventilation, keep your heart pumping, all that good stuff. So when you wake up in the morning,
staying alive, all that good stuff.
So when you wake up in the morning, you now have low liver stores of carbs, low glycogen in the liver, low glycogen in the muscles. And now when you do your aerobic, low, steady state session in the morning, you're dramatically ramping up fat burning and all these, even mitochondrial biogenesis, all these amazing adaptations. And you haven't really had to go harder per se. You know, you just tweaked how you fuel post and pre. If you even did that once a week, by the end of a month, you'd see some pretty good changes. And so that's the idea of just being a bit more strategic with how you're doing things, rather than, you know, most of us, if you are a bit type A, then it's always trying to run through the brick wall, which, you know, sometimes you need to do, but sometimes you can walk around it as well, right?
So before we're doing those slow, steady state aerobic activities, if we were to do that in the morning, should we be doing a coffee before that? Is that going to augment that performance, or should we do it in a fasted state?
So you can do it in a, you know, if you had a coffee, that would still be the fastest state, unless you added, you know, don't be adding any MCTs or any of that stuff to the coffee.
Yeah, just have a
plain old coffee or tea, then you're good to go. If that's not your thing, then, you know, you don't need to be adding that. You can go with just some water. But, you know, for a lot of people, a coffee helps to reduce perceived exertion a little bit and helps to get you motivated. So, but the key to that earlier morning session is to keep it aerobic. And I think that's where a lot of people, if you're used to always pushing hard, it's actually hard to pull yourself back. And one of the suggestions that we, you know, Phil Moffatone is a, you know, quite a legendary endurance coach, gives is to use 180 minus your age and then subtract 10 beats per minute off of that. And so let's say you're 40 years old. That's 180 minus 40. So you're down to 140. Take another 10 off, and that's 130 beats per minute would be the top end. So we would say to you, you cannot exceed 130 beats.
Like, that's low.
That's low. And so the person will come back and they'll say, well, geez, I couldn't get more than a quick walk. Perfect. You're training aerobically. Keep doing that. By the end of the month, the same heart rate, now you're jogging. So you've increased the speed at which you can work, but your heart rate hasn't changed. So now you could, that's an easy way for you to actually tell that you're improving aerobic fitness without any kind of machinery or anything else. But that's typically the first thing that people say is, wait a minute, like I can't even jog at that heart rate. And that lets you know that most of the time when you're doing your quote unquote cardio, you're actually in this glycolytic, you're burning carbohydrates rather than your fat stores for those sessions.
Interesting. And what about weight training? Like, is there an argument that we do aerobic in the morning and we pick a different type of day if we're lifting heavy weights, or just pick the time of day that works for you?
Yeah. When you look at the research, it's really about consistency. So whatever time of day, if you want to do it all at once, if you want to split it up, you know, at the very tip of the spear, there's a small marginal gains for maybe putting them in a certain order. But most of us, it's to think about that too early is going to throw things off. So it's really just about, when is this easiest for you to get in? When can you commit to it today? And then in week 26, you're still hitting the same number of sessions a week. And then that'll determine. And if it's only once a week you can do, then that's when you try to have a big session and get everything in. But if you can, you know, put two or three smaller sessions in, then that's a great way to be able to then spread it out a little bit. But either way, as long as you get the amount in per week, it's really up to you, up to your schedule, and up to what you like to be able to find the right approach.
Okay, I want to get into a few more biohacks in a few minutes, but I need to go down this rabbit hole because I have you here, and I can like feel our listeners wanting to ask this. Keto or not to keto, where are we at on this spectrum? This is not a dinner party. You can speak your mind.
This is not a dinner party. This is one of the things in the book of, you know, in elite performance, there's never a discussion around sort of absolute dietary strategies. So this whole train load discussion we've had is all about, you know, they would strategically and purposefully use sessions where they would, you know, the meal would look like a keto meal and you'd get an adaptation from that, but you wouldn't necessarily have to commit to the keto full stop. And the reason for that, again, is, you know, when researchers in Australia or Canada or in the US are doing all this research around endurance exercise, we haven't been able to see any medals being won by people who are strictly keto. Okay. Now, that doesn't mean you shouldn't, you know, if keto works for you, go for it. It's terrific. It can be helpful. But again, it's more this idea of once you have a dietary strategy that works for you, start playing with some of the nuances. You know, you have that intense session in your keto. Well, maybe this one day a week, you add more carbohydrates before that session. Because as, you know, some of the great nutritionists, in terms of female nutritionists, would tell you, is that sport nutritionists, that you're going to fuel that training with carbohydrates, you're going to get a better output. You're going to get a better training outcome in terms of how much effort you can put into that. So that this is where you start to get into the nuances then. You know, you've got your scaffolding of the typical approach that you tend to like. And then from there, you're going to strategically pick maybe meals of the week that are very low carb, some other meals that might be moderate, and some others that might be higher. And you just have a little detective work. And, you know, most of us have a meal on Friday or Saturday night that's a high carb meal anyway. So, you know, when you're out with friends or, you know, a nice Italian restaurant, maybe it's some pasta and bread. So that's already layered in there. It's all about having, you know, finding the other days that will work for you to really round out the approach. So again, all the approaches are fine. You always just want to ask yourself, like, am I achieving my goal? Because the goal shouldn't necessarily be just to see ketones in the urine or blood. It should be to achieve that X outcome in terms of the gym or in terms of your, you know, your work or your energy with the family life or whatnot. So sometimes we can get lost a little bit with the metrics and forget about the outcomes.
Well, I think it's a really great reminder. And I'm not sure what you see clinically and if you're working with a slightly different population, but I certainly see people moving in the direction of the results they want early on in a ketogenic diet. And then I just about always see people hit a wall of stress where if we're doing any kind of measurement related to blood or urine markers of adrenal fatigue, like people are hitting a wall really quickly on a keto diet, in particular women. So do you have any comment on that? Are you seeing similar things when you're looking at more objective findings in that sense?
Yeah, that's a really interesting one because when we look at, again, markers of nervous system stress in athletes, one of the best ones is to measure someone's resting metabolic rate. Of course, you have equations you can do that with, but when you do it in a lab, those two should match up. And when they don't, that lets you know that the athlete or the person is fatigued and has a sort of adrenal picture. And what can happen with a keto diet in the short term is you get a really big drop in caloric intake. Right? Because the most commonly consumed foods are higher in carbohydrate. All the processed foods are high in carbohydrate. So rather than having this kind of small drop in calories and this sort of 26 weeks or so approach, you get a 500, 600, 800 calorie drop, which is great in the first 4 weeks, seemingly. But because you've dropped calories so much, you're burning off a lot of muscle mass. And the tricky part with lean muscle is that it takes a long time to build and you can burn it off pretty quick. You know, unfortunately, and that'll impact your metabolic rate. And so now all of a sudden you felt good for a short period of time, but at the consequence of the longer term. So that's where you definitely, you know, if you did want to do that, then really ramping up your protein intake is almost the only way to save yourself in that scenario. And again, sport nutritionists like Susan Kleiner who work with female athletes, they use that in the acute, but they make sure they really ramp up the protein because that's the one way in a short period of time you can save yourself. But over the long haul, those big drops in calories are going to come back to bite you.
And let's talk about this. You mentioned metabolic rate. What's the connection between one's metabolic rate and thyroid health? And as the traditional ways that we're measuring thyroid health, is that the way that we should be doing it? Is like, what's the better approach to this thyroid lean muscle mass resting metabolic rate equation?
Yeah, this is one that definitely jumped out at me when I was talking with performance teams and looking at some of these new studies coming out, because sometimes I think we're chasing more of the smoke than we realize, because it looks as though, you know, thyroid markers, especially T3, are pretty sensitive to things like the overtraining and, you know, that stress and lack of resiliency. And so sometimes when we're seeing some of these modest elevations and it looks like a thyroid dysfunction, etc., we got to really ask ourselves, because if the person has reduced their caloric intake to try to, let's say, you know, lose weight, then that's going to impact that nervous system and those thyroid markers. Similarly, if they're training harder, again, resting metabolic rate is going to get impacted. You're going to get a bump up in the thyroid numbers. And so if we don't address this whole, how are you fueling, how are you exercising, you know, sleep piece, then, you know, it's going to be more difficult to be able to really not be chasing our tails a little bit with the thyroid numbers, unless you get those clients who are, you know, TSH of 7, 8, 9, 10 or really high that, you know, warrants medication. And we know that some of the outcomes in terms of, again, I talk weight loss here, but that's dovetailing this whole story along with fitness and how that impacts mental health as well. But it is interesting. Yeah, I mean, thyroid is definitely strongly connected to this sort of fatigue picture, that nervous system fatigue picture.
Yeah, I found that – I find thyroid is always the thing that we end up needing to look at. And in particular, in women, it's just so susceptible to an overtraining or high-stress scenario. We just need to be on the lookout for it.
Yeah, and it almost serves as a proxy. It's like with a lot of clients, they might tell you they're not as stressed as they actually are. And when you have this number that's quite high or this test that comes out, it's almost like an objective way of saying, well, rather than having to ask you, and again, subjective can be good, but sometimes rather than asking you, I can just show you this metric that's really telling me that your system, you know, the engine's running in the red here. You're burning out here, but we've got to do something to help address that, because otherwise you're just not going to be able to achieve what you want to achieve, right?
There's some key highlights in terms of the research that you have in your book and some interesting findings that came out of them. One of them that I found really interesting was this idea that there is a correlation between animals living longer and actually having a higher state of oxidative stress. Can you comment on that? Because I feel like anyone who walks through a health food store, they have, you know, antioxidants and lower your oxidative stress supplements shoved down your throat. And in fact, one of the findings you talk about in the book is that research is actually showing some models where that's the opposite.
Yeah, this is pretty fascinating. So that oxidative stress theory around longevity comes from the 1950s and famous researcher named Denham Harmon. And the idea was that, yeah, as oxidative stress increases, you know, it's like the exhaust that's coming out of your car. This is leading to cellular stress and leading to aging. And this is the part of the story that the, you know, certain animals, reptiles and birds, and one of them in particular we talk about in the books, the naked mole rat, which looks a little bit like Dr. Evil's pet cat there in the Austin Powers movie back in the day, but that these animals are living the longest and they have the highest levels of oxidative stress. You know, a few decades ago, that sort of flipped things on its head a little bit in terms of this longevity, you know, healthy aging realm, because it really emphasized the fact that it is your resiliency. It is your capacity to cope with the stress that matters, not the total amount of stress in the system. And you see that even in, again, back to sport, you know, international level athletes who are your Olympic athletes, they can train longer and harder than national level athletes and not get sick. And again, no one can quite figure out why. You know, are they just better at managing their nutrition and training plan and sleep or whatnot? But again, it's this internal capacity to cope with stress and to have a greater resiliency. And so those of us who are maybe not as genetically gifted to have this inherently great resiliency, that's that piece of getting back to, you know, what you're doing from a nutrition, movement, lifestyle. And in the book, we talk about, you know, fasting glucose being this marker that can really give us some insight, because if you train too hard for too long, if you're not getting enough sleep, then those markers start to really creep up. And the kind of scary part is that even in normal, healthy populations, if you're in the upper quartile of blood glucose, then you're at much greater risk of cardiovascular disease, and much greater risk of all these, you know, metabolic syndrome and some of these conditions like that. So it's definitely one where, yeah, the antioxidant supplements, food first approach is a huge one there in terms of getting those antioxidants from what you're eating. And then, getting back to that resiliency piece for sure.
Well, I really resonate with that, because when people ask me how I define health, I always talk about it in the context of physiological resilience. So the more you're able to handle coming at you, to me, that's one of the determinants of health. It's not the absence of disease. And in our practice, and I'm not sure if you're using these at all, we're using heart rate variability monitors. And low HRV is also associated with one, decreased resilience. And interestingly enough, low HRV scores are associated with all of those chronic diseases that you just talked about. So cardiovascular, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, that whole spectrum of conditions, we also see with low HRV. So it's another argument around this idea of doing what you can do to increase one's resilience.
Yeah, and metrics like that is getting easier and easier to collect, things like HRV, and, you know, we talk about recovery metrics in the book and this idea of, you know, using rolling averages of HRV and various things to help highlight that. But just like you said, yeah, diabetes, even things like dehydration, you see, you know, it'll impact your HRV. And when it comes to even, you know, we talked about antioxidants and polyphenols. What blew me away was finding out that 50% of the polyphenols that we get are from coffee and tea. So if you have somebody who doesn't drink coffee or tea and doesn't have a very good diet, I mean, right off the bat, you can see how there's a real big gap there. And the nice part with the polyphenols is it doesn't matter if it's caffeinated or uncaffeinated in terms of the, you know, if you're going for a decaf coffee, you're still getting these benefits, which is pretty cool as well.
Right. And when we're talking about the polyphenols in coffee, we're talking about black coffee, correct?
Yeah. So black coffee, I mean, you can add some milk to it and still be getting, you know, many of these benefits. But the benefits are for caffeinated, decaffeinated. And actually, I don't know if you saw, the University of Toronto just came out with that study showing if you're a habitual coffee drinker and you just look at and smell coffee, you get the same cognitive benefits as if you had just drunk the coffee. So it looks like there's a big Pavlov's dog effect here going on for most of us, which is we don't, you know, just walk into the coffee shop, take a big whiff, and then you should be good to go.
This is a new business model for me. You just walk into my store, you sniff, and you leave, and you are,
there you go.
It's way cheaper.
Turnstiles.
Let's talk about this coffee piece for a little bit, because I think coffee drinkers love nothing more than to have that behavior reinforced.
I'll put my hand up, guilty as charged.
Well, that's just it. So I maybe have a little Nespresso habit that I have developed myself, but when we're picking coffee, are there things that we should be looking for in terms of how do we really benefit? If we're going to do a habit every day, we might as well benefit from it. So what should we be looking for in optimizing our coffee habit?
Yeah, this is one where I had a chance to speak with Dr. Nancy Guest, who does a lot of research in nutrigenomics. And of course, you know, caffeine is one of the better SNPs that we have in terms of the research. And you can effectively now, through a genetic test, figure out if you're a slow metabolizer, fast metabolizer. And in her research, she actually found a subgroup called ultra slow metabolizers, which unfortunately, those are the ones that actually get even a performance decrement when they do exercise. So it actually makes their aerobic exercise worse, which is unfortunate. That's only 10% of folks, but
sucks to be them.
Sucks to be them. So that's one way to find out is to, you know, run a genetic test. But when you look at the research, the dose that tends to be most beneficial is going to be around the 3 to 4 milligrams per kilogram body weight. You know, if you're 160 pounds, you know, you're only looking at something like 200 plus milligrams in it per day. So that's not much more than one coffee, unfortunately. Up to 6 milligrams per kilogram, you can see, but that's when those anxiety type symptoms start coming up, you know, the mind racing, the jitteriness, all these types of things. So trying to nail down the right dose for you, because I think a lot of people might forget that, you know, that venti at Starbucks has got almost 500 milligrams of caffeine in just one. So if you're knocking back two or three of those in a day, you know, it's not going to help in terms of your, it's going to be too much to really support cognitive function. You're going to be spinning your wheels a little bit. And then on the back end with sleep, it's going to be really hanging out a long time in your system and starting to interfere with that sleep quality piece. So I think trying to nail down that dose that's right for yourself. And again, if you can mix in some of these decaf coffees, if you do enjoy having more than one, then the research shows you're still going to get a lot of the benefits. And we even see it in sport, actually. You can give someone a decaf and tell them it's caffeinated and they run faster. So it's there's a lot of the mental side going into what we take in, whether it's from food or supplements, and coffee's fits that bill as well.
Well, let's talk about that mental side a little bit, because I think it's one of the things that really gets it gets underestimated by the average person. But anyone who is working with elite athletes or with anyone in elite capacity understands that it is actually the differentiator between people who are just doing the average thing and people who are executing at a really high level. And I know you have a lot to say on these pieces, but can you give us some examples from your research in terms of truly the power of working on and addressing mindset when you're looking to perform in life at an elite level?
This is definitely another sort of jaw-dropping area where you think if you're the best of the best at a sport, like legendary, world-class, you just assume that these things come naturally. You know, you don't assume that they're still literally working on the fundamentals. And the case that I'm talking about is with Serena Williams, who's could be the greatest female tennis player ever. You know, yeah, have you heard of her? She's pretty darn good. And so even a few years ago, back when she was, you know, this is around 2013, 14, you could see her at changeover. So, you know, between games, when they stop and have a sip of water or a sip of their electrolyte drink, she'd open up a notebook and be reading out positive affirmations. Things like, you will move up, you will add spin, you will win. And that's just mind-boggling to think that someone who already had, you know, more than a dozen majors, who was already, you know, far, far ahead of her competition, was still going back to these things, still herself had doubts, which, I mean, if you ever watched her play tennis, I mean, there's no more dominating female player out there than Serena Williams. And so I think that really resonates, that for the rest of us, we need to keep working on these things, even if we might think that we have them under wraps, or maybe we actually overlooked them. Because, again, going through some of the classic research, William Hart, University of Alabama, you know, the language that we're actually using to describe our situations, you know, that starts to determine actually how we see it and how we experience it and how we actually participate in it, which is pretty overwhelming to think about. You're just, your version of the events is playing a huge role in all this. And because the brain tends to default to negative thinking, when you sleep, when you get less than 7 hours of sleep, if you're working long weeks, you actually then start to increase the amount of negative thoughts as well. So we're, if you're in this soup where you're really pushing the limits and working hard and not sleeping enough, you're going to be pulled in this direction of having more sort of negative self-talk and doubt and things like that. And so, you know, that's a nice fundamental to be adding in, of, you know, a short strategy, whether it's 5 or 10 minutes of reinforcing some of these things so that you can start to get some more of that positive self-talk and control the narrative a little more in between the years.
Well, yeah. And sometimes it's the power of self-talk and sometimes it's the power of reframing. And I think you referenced Kelly McGonigal or Peter Jensen and this real capacity of elite athletes to be able to reframe the pressure or the adversity that they're facing. Can you comment on that a little bit? Because I feel like there is nothing that is more unifying for entrepreneurs than this idea that, you know, some days are great and other days you just feel like you're battling up a hill. How can we reframe that in such a way that it feels more like we're gliding?
Yeah, that was a really refreshing TED talk that Kelly McGonigal, who's a PhD health psychologist at Stanford, you know, and she was mentioning how she spent years and years telling people stress is bad and stress isn't good for you. And then all of a sudden, you know, her research is showing that just believing stress is bad makes all the outcomes worse. And so again, this sort of mindset piece becomes massive. And the notion that, you know, pressure is a privilege. And so that's one. Peter Jensen's the sports psych at Canada Basketball, you know, legendary psychologist here in Canada, and reinforcing this notion that if you feel pressure, I mean, that's a good thing. It means that you care and it means that you think you can make a difference. And so I think, again, when we're feeling good, we can harness that sort of positive side of stress. But when we start to, you know, not get enough sleep, when the diet's not on point, we're not getting enough exercise, these things really start to take a hit. And one of the things that stuck with me with Dr. Jensen as well is, even when we're trying to communicate ideas to others, you know, sometimes we almost appeal to logic a little too much. And, you know, maybe the marketers out there already know this, but, you know, emotions and imagery are the things that really change people, is what Dr. Jensen says. And so finding that way to connect with them on that level. And I think even sometimes as clinicians or practitioners, we tend to rely too much on this logic piece of, you know, well, you shouldn't drink so much, or you shouldn't smoke, or you shouldn't do X, Y, or Z. And, you know, the patient or the client's probably pretty aware of that. It's more, again, how do we build this relationship, this connection? And yeah, the ability to build these relationships is a way how you can start to influence these behaviors. So it really is, you know, that mindset piece, the emotion piece is a pretty powerful trigger. And the interesting thing now in sport is that if you ask most of these performance directors, whether it's the NBA or whatnot, NFL, the emotional part of it is becoming a huge player in this whole story of performance.
We've all heard that mindset has a huge influence on our ability to be effective and amplify in this world. But what if I told you your brain biochemistry, literally the neurotransmitters that are existing within your nervous system, can help amplify your mindset or your capacity to be effective? They can help accelerate your mission in the world. More and more with both my coaching clients and my patients, we end up having a conversation related to our own ability to control our nervous system through the optimization of neurotransmitters. Now, what the heck do I mean by this? The foods that you eat, the way that you think, your interaction with the world has the capacity to increase things like serotonin or dopamine, some of these really important neurotransmitters to helping you be effective and operate at your best. After listening to literally thousands of conversations with my clients and with my patients, I pulled together a very quick checklist so that you could have a better understanding of the things you're doing every single day to amplify your nervous system or downregulate it in a way that isn't necessarily serving your mission. If you want access to this information and want to learn a little bit more about how you can optimize your brain health for success, visit meganwalker.com/brainhealth to grab your handout now. Now, back to our episode. I think this is actually a perfect place for us to transition in the interview from you sharing all this other wisdom that you found in your research and for us to get a like under the hood view of how you are living your life. And so I call this our KPI section or key performance indicators. So just like we have them in our business, I believe we have them in our life as well. So I've got some questions for you, my friend. Coming at you. Remember, pressure's a privilege. Here we go.
Exactly. There you go.
Question number one, who's inspiring you right now?
That's a great question. And I think it's actually my kids. I think it's my one-year-old at the moment. I mean, just the level of determination to be able to continually give me the cross-arm, forearm, elbow to be able to get to what she wants, and the positive outlook too, just the laughing, the playing, you know. I think sometimes we can get so deep in our rabbit holes that we, you know, we start to forget all the other aspects of life. So yeah, definitely the kids are helping me to reframe, and for sure.
So nice and so true. What is your audacious goal for the next year?
My audacious goal for the next year is to get more than 6 hours of sleep in a night in a row.
To survive having three kids under seven.
The first chapter of the book is all about sleep and all about the negatives of not enough sleep, and I think that's the idea. Sometimes we just get in these periods of life where it's really tough to be able to do it. And you got to find the time to carve out the naps or whatever else. But yeah, it can be tough. And there you go. That's on me now for the summertime. Naps in the park.
We're going to check in after your third book and see how that's going. What is the one thing you're most consistent with respect to your health?
Well, I don't know how, maybe this started out as positive, but I decided to join the wine club a year ago. I thought this was a great way to get my polyphenol intake up in a, you know, pretty relaxing way. The only problem is they send you these boxes a little too frequently. So I think that's been one. Unfortunately, I've been a little too consistent.
Our listeners are loving this elite performance conversation. We're like wine clubs and caffeine. Like if you just jumped in the last 10 minutes, this is like the ultimate of all. I can't even talk. The ultimate of all episodes.
There you go. So yeah, I've been definitely consistent with the wine. The one thing I've tried to do after talking with Dr. Bender is trying to consume it a little earlier so that it doesn't interfere with sleep, which is a nice little hack.
It's 11 a.m. somewhere, right? What is something totally badass about you that people would not otherwise know?
Well, I once sailed through the Panama Canal and things got back jammed. So we had to spend the night in the Panama Canal on a yacht that was about to cross the Pacific. So we tied up with about three or four other of these. And I was just helping out here. I was just like the, you know, the person holding the ropes, but all these yachts tied up together. We had a big old party in the middle of the Panama Canal, and there you go.
That's kind of awesome.
That seems like a long time ago.
Back when I was young. What do you do for fun or play?
I used to play basketball and lift weights, but now I chase after little people. I still try to get active and get moving. It's amazing how now it really is just like a, just in terms of a total stress relief and clearing the mind of, you know, getting out for actually even, I didn't used to run very much. Was more chasing balls and playing sports, but now even just some good 20, 30 minutes to clear the head and get some oxygen in is a pretty nice way to reboot for sure.
And finally, entrepreneurism. Are we born this way or do we learn to become entrepreneurs?
That's a great question. And that was one in the leadership section where this idea of our leaders born or made, and it was almost split between the two. And I'd have to go with, I think they can be sort of born, so to speak, but I definitely think in anybody it can be made as well. So it all depends on where your passion lies, I think.
Such a great answer. And this has been truly a fascinating interview. Dr. Bubs, people are going to want to learn more. We'll hook them up in the show notes, but where can we send them to hear a little bit more about what you're up to?
Absolutely. Yeah. If they're curious about the book Peak, you can check that out at Chapters Indigo, Barnes & Noble, all your Amazon, all your online retailers. You can check out more about my work on social media at Dr. Bubs. And then, of course, the website is drbubs.com.
Amazing. We will hook everyone up. Such a pleasure to talk to you, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Awesome. Thanks so much for having me.
So, how was that for you? How did you enjoy today's podcast? If you guys are enjoying what you are listening to, I would so appreciate a review from you. Head on over to iTunes, search for the Entrepology Podcast, and share with us your 5-star feedback related to what we are throwing down in the business, body, and inner badass world. And if you want to learn more about Dr. Bubs and the work that he is doing, you can head on over to my website, which is meganwalker.com/podcast/episode 124. Thanks for being here, everybody.